Support for WGTD comes from Jack and Drea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2019. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. More information at jackandrea.com. Jack and Drea, a proud supporter of WGTD's morning show. And we welcome you to the Thursday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Today is the monthly visit of Nan Calvert, and it is always a delight to have her on the morning show. And she always brings with her an interesting guest or two to talk about some matter related to the environment. And today we're going to be talking about something that is incredibly basic and largely overlooked and yet so essential to human life here on Earth, namely the earth beneath our feet, specifically the soil. And we're going to be exploring soil today with Laura Schultz, who is on the faculty at the University of Wisconsin Parkside in their environmental sciences department. And we're going to be talking a little bit about that program and what it means to study environmental science at Parkside, but then very specifically, talk about soil. So first of all, we welcome both of you to the morning show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good to have you here. So Nan, say a quick word about why you think it is worth our time to talk about something as ordinary as soil. I'm setting you up here.
See, that's the thing. We think it's ordinary, but it's not ordinary. Mm-hmm. You know, we spend a lot of time talking about air quality and water quality and habitat quality, but we often don't speak specifically about soil, which is just a crying shame because, you know, it is the substrate of life for us. And we treat it as something that we can just sort of use and abuse. And we have very little understanding of what soil is, what role it plays, and the essential nature of having healthy soils. Most of us don't know that there are actually native soils, just like there are native birds and native plants and other native things. We move it around and we don't really think about the impact of moving soil from one place to the other. And I have long wanted to have someone on the show who can sort of wax poetic about soil and hopefully inspire people to begin to, if not love it, at the very least begin to have a deeper understanding of it and an improved regard for it. So that's why we're here today. And can I just say something? Because sometimes you ask me how I know our guests.
Yeah.
So the funny thing is, Laura and I were at an event a couple of months ago for Root Pike Watershed Initiative Network, and we were standing next to each other, and we were both sort of looking at each other thinking, gosh, you look awfully familiar. Turns out, when Laura was a kid, I was her teaching naturalist at Riverbend Nature Center.
Oh.
And now look at her. She's at Parkside.
So bitten by the bug in a really big way. Very good. Laura, it's great to have you here on the morning show, and I'm happy that we can make your acquaintance. How long have you been on the faculty at Parkside?
I started at Parkside in April of 2016, so almost 3 years.
Okay.
Now.
Still pretty new. And did I hear you say that you actually went there as a student, as an undergrad?
I did, yeah. I was a geoscience major.
Very good. And apparently from around here, you grew up here.
Yep, I grew up in Racine, went to Walden for high school, yep, native.
Very good. So at what point did matters related to the environment and the natural world around us start to become really important to you?
Oh, I would say that, well, I obviously went to Riverbend as a kid. I really liked being outside and spent a lot of my summers doing outdoor activities, and I've always been a big fan of animals, and I've always been a big animal person, but I had this dream I was going to be a vet when I was in high school. Then I dissected the fetal pig freshman year and decided that was not what I wanted to do, so I needed to figure something else out. And I went to my parents actually dragged me to this, it was like a science day at Parkside where you could go learn about different majors that you could major in at Parkside that were related to science, because I knew I wanted to do something with science, but I didn't really know what I wanted to do, and I wasn't real excited about college. And so I went to this day at Parkside, and I talked to Dr. Wolf, Dr. Joy Wolf, and geography was one of them I met. And she had a little display on soils and biogeography and things that she did. And then I met Dr. Chris Evans, who's no longer at Parkside. She's retired, but she was a soil scientist in the geoscience department, and she had a few of her students there that day, and they dragged me to the club room, the geoscience club room, and showed me all the cool research stuff they got to do, and I thought it looked really neat. And I also had this idea that I was going to be a farmer, and I still have that idea, so I thought geoscience was the closest route to get there.
Absolutely. I could see that being a very smooth path indeed. Well, this is great. And then what did you do right after you graduated from Parkside?
I went directly to UW-Madison for my master's degree. I went for soil science. Obviously, for my master's, I focused in soil fertility. I worked with the state fertility. She's actually a UW Extension agent, but has a joint appointment at Parkside, Dr. Carrie Lebowski. She's on the state soil fertility specialist. So I worked with dairy manure and the sandy soils in Adams County. So it was a neat project. I really liked it a lot.
Wow. And then fairly soon thereafter, I'm guessing you made your way to the Parkside faculty then.
Yeah, I worked for a few. I stayed on in Madison for a couple years. I worked in a few different labs. I worked in one lab under Dr. Philip Barak. His lab has a spinoff company called Nutrient Upcycle. It's NRU, Nutrient. Oh, I don't remember what it stands for now. Sorry, Phil. I don't think he's listening. He lives in Madison. But they work at doing nutrient recovery from wastewater. So I kind of kept with the poop theme for a little while.
Okay.
So he was kind of the oddball in the soils department, which was really fun because everyone else was doing very traditional types of soils work, and he was kind of branching out and doing something a little different, which was neat. And then I worked in the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center for a while on campus, and in a lab that was looking at biofuels production. The Jackson Lab was the name of that one. So that one is more of farming type work that
very
I did in
good.
There. Then I got the job at Parkside, so I moved back here.
You know, just as you've been describing some of the different things you've done in terms of these different labs you worked in, it helps me understand the answer to a question I was going to ask. I don't know that I will ask it exactly. Maybe I will, sort of. It's true, obviously, as Nan was saying right at the outset, that soil is complicated. And yet it also seems like something that by now we should completely understand, that there shouldn't be anything left to study about soil. I mean, people who don't know anything about soil obviously are going to go take classes and learn about soil, but it seems like at the front end we should already know everything there is to know about soil. And again, it's because I think we think of it as such an ordinary thing. But just in your touching on the things that you've done in various research labs, we realize that, yes, there are all kinds of ways in which something even as basic as soil still needs to be explored and understood even more fully.
Oh, yeah. Soil biology in particular is really complex. There's like billions of organisms living within a teaspoon of soil, and we have no idea what half of them are. I went to this presentation when I was in grad school that I understood like 99% of it, where this researcher was talking about how she took soil and then put it into this fancy machine, which I didn't understand how it worked, and then it chunked out all this genetic information from within the soil. And she was like, yeah, we have all this genetic information, and we have no idea what these creatures are that are living within it, which is pretty cool.
Wow.
That there's so much to learn.
And I suppose that's part of it, too, is that science itself has advanced in terms of the way in which it's possible to study soil is very different than it was 30, 40, 50 years ago.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
We have Laura Schultz with us, who is from the Environmental Sciences faculty at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside, and she is here at the invitation of Nan Calvert, and soils are what we're going to be talking about for this hour. So I know one of the things that Nan was most important to her is for us to try to disavow everybody listening to us right now of ever calling soil dirt.
Yes.
Soil is not dirt. They are not synonyms. Laura, maybe you could clarify that for us. I mean, there is such a thing as dirt, I'm pretty sure, but then there's this other thing called soil. I mean, are they overlapping terms or are they completely different things? Should we never use the term dirt? I mean, help us sort out those two words.
Sure. When I was in school, I had a professor that said that dirt was what's under your fingernails, and soil is what sustains life. And that was that was the difference. A lot of soil scientists get very offended if you call soil dirt. I was in the field once with one of my pedology professors, and my friend just happened to call soil dirt by mistake, and he went off on this rant for like a half hour on how it is not dirt. And she was like, I'm really sorry, I know, but I personally don't. If you're I guess I don't find as much offense to some soil scientists do. I have some bags that say, like, I heart dirt and different things like that. And I think that's okay. If you're using dirt in the derogatory way, then I would prefer if you did not apply it to soils.
So, but it sounds like the answer right at the outset makes a lot of sense, which is that when it's on us, it becomes dirt. I mean, dirt makes people dirty. So that's... And I suppose conceivably you could have soil on you, and in a sense it's also dirt because it's making you dirty. But the thing that we see in a farmer's field is not dirt. Mm-hmm. That is soil.
Yes, yes.
What can you tell us about that word? Do you know anything about where it comes from or how long we've used it?
Oh, that's a great question. No, I have no idea. Do you, Nan?
I have no idea. Callers, call it. No,
I'll do a little searching over here. I mean, it's never dawned on me to even ask that. I mean, I've never thought about
question.
It. I've never thought.
Thanks for listening, everybody.
Yeah, right. Well, let's talk about things that are even more important than the word itself. So, a couple of the things you've already said have pointed to the really important truth that there is all kinds of stuff in soil. And Nan, I think right off the bat, you described it as almost a living thing, mm-hmm. and certainly something that's full of living matter. Yeah. That's for sure. So Laura Schultz, what are the most important elements that comprise most soil?
Ooh, so all of the organisms that are living in soil are really, really important. There's fungi, there's different bacteria. There's some bacteria, they call them nitrogen-fixing bacteria, and these are bacteria that nitrogen is not an element that we can harvest from rocks. Like, we can get our rock phosphorus for our fertilizers from mining rock phosphate. Nitrogen, we get it from the atmosphere. And before we figured out how to synthetically fix that nitrogen ourselves into fertilizer, we relied on these, and we still rely to a lot of extent on microbes within the, or these little nitrogen fixing bacteria within the soil that are able to take nitrogen directly from the atmosphere and add it into the soil. So I like to think they're one of the most important things in the soil, particularly in terms of agricultural soils, because nitrogen is always the limiting factor, or most of the time is the limiting factor for plant growth. That's, if you talk to a farmer, nitrogen is the one that they're always trying to get more of on their farms to increase their yields. So nitrogen is really, these little bacteria are very important within soils. Organic matter is also really important within soil. That's all of the decayed and partially decayed, like living material, like your plants and your animals and things that have died, and their nutrients are being back into the soil. Most soils have about, if you look at the volume of soil, about 5% of it is actually organic matter. So it's not a huge percentage of soil is organic matter, but its properties are really important. That's where you're going to get a lot of your nutrients for your microbes that are performing the activities you need them to do in the soil. They need nourishment, and so organic matter is their primary source of food. Organic matter is very good at sticking soil particles together, and so that helps make, we call those soil structure, when you look at how the soil is formed. And if you have a soil that has good soil structure, there's less chance of erosion occurring in that soil. Soils with good structure also have better water infiltration, which is really important when you're looking at soils that are in areas where you get a lot of rainfall. You don't want flooding and erosion to occur if you have a soil that's able to soak up that water. And that makes water available for plants if you're able to have a soil that can hold that. So organic matter is really, really important within the soil as well. Clays are also the other big important factor in soils. And I know I hear this a lot, particularly in this area, that people hate the clay. They're like, oh, our soils are so clay here and I can't plant my crops and blah, blah, blah. But the clay is really important because clay has charges on it. The way the clay is structured, if you look at its molecular structure, it has a negative charge on the outer particles. And so those charges are able to hang on to different nutrients and water that are moving through the soil and hang on to those, and then able to give those to plants. If you have too much clay in your soil, it can hold that water too tightly and those nutrients too tightly, so plants can't get a hold of that. But if you have the
soil hoards it.
Yes, you want the right balance of clay within your soil.
I'm sorry.
Oh, go ahead.
It just made me think, you know, people do lament about our clay we have lots of clay, mm-hmm. especially pockets around like Caledonia and places like that. But, you know, there are at least 200 different kinds of native plants that do exceptionally well in clay. That's their native home base, basically. And people spend a lot of time, not necessarily in agriculture, but in conventional gardening practices, trying to change the essential structure of soil by adding things. But it's always going to go back to what it was intended to be.
Hmm.
So if you begin to incorporate native plants into your landscape, as I always encourage people to do, you have a whole plethora of plants from which to choose.
And with less work.
And with less work and, you know.
Because you don't have to take the soil and try to transform it into something that it probably wasn't meant to be.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. They always want to add sand to the soil is the question I get, which hypothetically you can to make the soil fluffier for your plants. But I think it's much better to work with what you have, too. Yeah, mm-hmm. Our soil here is very nice, even mm-hmm. though there is some clay in it.
Interesting. So we sometimes hear the term topsoil. How is the term topsoil related to just the general term soil? Topsoil is soil, obviously. Is there other kinds of soil that's not topsoil?
Absolutely, yeah. The topsoil is like the top of the soil. That's basically what it is.
Really?
That's the soil in your upper. We call them in soil science, you have different layers of soil, and we call them horizons. Your topsoil is your top horizon, which we call the A horizon, which my students are learning right now in soils, and they have a quiz on tomorrow, so hopefully they know what that is. Your A horizon. And your topsoil, that's typically where you're going to have your most organic matter. That's where your plant roots typically are found. There are some plants that are able to soak down into the lower sub-horizons, but typically your A horizon is where a lot of your roots are going to be found. A lot of your biological activity, like your bugs, are going to be living up there. Some of your burrowing critters will be living in the topsoil. That's typically usually about a foot in some places. Thicker in some, thinner in others. I'd say a foot is usually a good gauge. And that's where farmers are growing their crops. If you're a gardener, that's where you would be growing your plants. That's really important that your topsoil, that it's nutritious, so that the plants are getting the nutrients that they need. And it's also really important that you take care of the topsoil. If your topsoil erodes away, or you let those nutrients, if you till too much is a problem, that can cause your organic matter within your soil to, they call it oxidizing, then that vaporizes, and then that organic material is no longer present. That can make that soil not as nutrient rich as it used to be. And tillage also breaks up. We just talked about those nice soil structure, and keeping soil and structure in place is really important for maintaining good water infiltration, which is important for the plants, and also keeping that soil from eroding away. So that's like when you look at like the classic example of the Dust Bowl, right? When farmers removed all of the native vegetation to grow wheat, there was nothing in place to hold that topsoil down. And so when the winds on the prairie, and there's nothing on the prairies to stop the winds either, right? And so when the winds came through, it was able to pick up those particles of topsoil and blow them away. And then you're stuck with, they call it the subsoil, and that's typically, we call that the B horizon, which isn't as nutritious as your A horizon. It's typically lighter. If you're digging in your backyard, you can tell when you've hit the B horizon, because you'll see a change in color, the dark, your topsoil is usually very dark, and then your subsoil is a little bit lighter, more like a brown instead of a black. There's not as much organic matter there, and there's also more accumulation of clay. So if you don't like your clays, you really want to keep that, work in your topsoil, make sure that's preserved, because otherwise you're going to hit that subsoil that has more clay.
Interesting. So for instance, back in the Dust Bowl years, where so much of the topsoil was blown away, so then you had farmers left, I suppose, with nothing except to try and grow things in that B soil or that B horizon of soil, which is not the same thing at all and probably yielded very little, I'm guessing.
Exactly, yeah. And well, the Dust Bowl was confounded too, right, that they had a drought. So they had no rain, which was a problem. In the B horizon, typically you don't have as much organic matter, so it's not able to hold what water you do receive as well as the A horizon. So, yeah, they had big problems. That's why you should not leave your soil empty. Like, when you see barren lots of just soil sitting there in farm fields during the winter, like, that soil is subjected to erosion and wind and water erosion, which can cause that topsoil to go away and not be good for next year's crops.
And we need that. We need that. For those of you just joining us, we're speaking with Laura Schultz, who is from the Environmental Sciences Faculty at the University of Wisconsin Parkside. And we're here with Nan Calvert, and we are talking primarily about soils today and the importance of soils and what we can do to take care of them. So what is the process by which soil is created? And is it something that's, in a sense, kind of perpetually created if human beings don't get in the way?
Yeah. So soils form from, we call it parent material, and that's either bedrock. Most of the time it is bedrock. In our area, a lot of our soils formed from, they call it glacial till. And that's the deposits that when the glaciers came here during the last ice age, and then they retreated, all of the stuff that they left behind, like their rocks and their little pebbles and things, all of that glacial till over time through weathering processes has become soil. In some areas in Wisconsin, too, we have parent material that was glacial loess, and that's wind-blown deposits. So when the glaciers were receding, the deposits that they left behind, some of those particles were able to be picked up by the wind and carried to other areas and deposited in thick enough layers that soil was able to form from those as well. Yeah, so soil forms from, we call it weathering. The weathering process, there's two main types. There's chemical weathering and physical weathering. Physical weathering is where you're just breaking up the material. There's no chemical change to this to that material. It's just like you have a slab of rock and you're breaking up into smaller pieces. So that could be done through, like, if water gets into the rock and then it freezes and thaws, it's going to cause cracking. If the rock is heated, that could cause exfoliation where it, like, peels like an orange, layers like an orange does. And then chemical weathering is where you're actually changing the chemical composition of the soil. So you're taking those minerals that are within your rock or your glacial till, and it's typically done by water and oxygen processes where they're chemically altering that into a substance that then becomes soil.
Wow. And what are the ways in which we interfere with that process of soil being created?
Well, it takes a very long time for soil to form. For about centimeter inch of soil, it takes about 100 years for that to form, and we can destroy it in like 2 seconds with with a bulldozer. So that's primarily the main way that we go through is removing the topsoils and changing our soils through construction practices and like Nan was saying, people taking soils from other areas and dump it into their backyard. That's changing that soil as well. There's going to be different microbes and potentially plant seeds in that soil that's going to have to adjust and change the ecosystem of that. The good news is, for the most part, we don't usually hit bedrock, so we're not really changing the bedrock, which is like the foundation of what soil forms from. But mainly we alter soil formation by stopping what the soil has done and removed it, and then telling it has to start over, basically, which is a nice thing
else
to do.
Yeah. Do you think the way Nan is characterizing soils is some soils being actually kind of native soils that aligns with your understanding of soil?
Yeah. When you're looking at new areas where they're building houses or golf courses are a big culprit of this too, where they're taking in materials that are from outside of the area and bringing it in, you're going to be, that's not a native soil, right? You're going to be changing that that soil ecosystem that was there present. And you're, sometimes what they'll do is they will put the new soil on top of an old soil, and so you'll get two soil profiles on top of each other, which is kind of cool when you actually see it in the field, but not so great when you're thinking about potentially of what happened in that area, where you'll get a new soil that forms on top of an old soil profile that was already there.
Right.
You know, and a lot of people go to home improvement centers and garden centers, and they buy bags of soil. You don't even know where they're coming from unless you turn the bag over and this is from Pennsylvania or whatever. So we do alter the soil profiles, if you will, you know, without even thinking about it, because we don't know about it. You know, we don't really learn that in school, like a lot of other things that we don't learn. But it is important, particularly when you're talking about invasive species and other things. You have the potential to do great good, but you also have the potential to do a lot of damage.
Yeah, I think if you're a person that really wants to mend your soil and make it better for gardening or for your backyard, one of the best ways to do that is to add compost to your soil, or to also add different, even doesn't have to be completely to the compost stage, just or any organic matter you can get on that soil too, like leaf clippings, grass clippings can be pretty good. Milorganite is a great product. I don't know if you guys know about Milorganite. That's they make it out of the Milwaukee Metropolitan Sewage District. It's their basically their wastewater that taken the sludge and they dried it, and it's really high in organic matter. It's more of a soil amendment than a fertilizer, because they're not usually, when you're looking at a fertilizer, you classify those by the nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium concentrations. And those concentrations are lower than a typical synthetic fertilizer. But the organic matter in Milorganite is just phenomenal. And that'll do a really, really good job at improving your gardens and flower beds and backyards and things as well.
So your suggestion for somebody is to just directly apply that stuff right into their soil. Typically, how do you suggest somebody do that? I mean, what does that sort of physical act look like?
Sure. When I've done it in my personal gardens, I didn't use Milorganite. I had a friend that had a horse farm, and he had a bunch of composted manure that had been composting for so long that it almost looked like topsoil. And we just took it out to our this was with a group of friends in graduate school. We got my friend to bring his truck, and we filled the whole bed with horse manure, and then we brought it out to our garden plot, and we just spread it across the garden plot, and then we let water infiltrate that organic matter into the soil profile.
And then that just sort of happens from there.
Mm-hmm. Yep, and the microbes will help break it down. The rainwater is a big one of adding it in. You don't really have to. There's a lot of people who would prefer to mechanically incorporate it, which you can if you prefer, but we just left it on top and left it for nature to incorporate it itself.
To nature to do its thing. This reminds me of something you said earlier in the conversation. You talked about studying soil fertility. What does that term exactly mean?
Sure. Soil fertility is the study of how nutritious the soil is. In classic fertility, you're mainly dealing with, when you're working with agricultural farmers, you're dealing with nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium are the big three. And so that's doing the study of looking at, if I apply this type of fertilizer at this time of year on this type of soil growing this type of plant, like how much of this nutrient gets into this plant, how much of it stays in the soil, how much of it is potentially removed out of the soil profile and gone into the groundwater below the soil. And also just looking at your native soils in general, taking samples and analyzing them to see how much of those elements are within the soils themselves, because there are some soils that are just naturally more nutritious than other soils. And one of the most nutritious soils we have in the state is just outside of Madison in Arlington, Wisconsin. It's called the Plano silt loam. It's the home of the, or this takes up most of the, it's called the Arlington Agricultural Research Station. UW-Madison has these research stations all over the state, and Arlington is the big hub. And that soil is incredibly productive. They've had really good luck with, which can sometimes interfere with some of the studies they're doing at Arlington, because the soil is just so nutritious in general that sometimes they don't see effects of applying different fertilizers on there. So there have been some groups that are like, well, maybe we need to start. That's why we have it in other parts of the state,
right?
So we can study this fertilizer in a soil that's maybe not as good as the Plano silt loam. The sad thing about the Plano silt loam is it's in Arlington, which is basically a suburb in a sense of Madison. As Madison continues to grow, we're developing houses on top of the Plano silt loam and buildings and businesses, because Madison doesn't have any room to expand, basically.
Right.
Yeah, it makes the soil scientists at Madison very sad.
Right.
Like this is happening, that we're putting houses on some of the most fertile soil in the state.
Right, that could be used for growing things.
Yes.
Besides daffodils or whatever. Yeah.
Just as a quick aside, the other thing that we often don't realize is that soils have names. So we have Plano silt loam. Our state soil is Antigo silt loam. There are dozens and dozens and dozens of names for the soils in Wisconsin alone. That notwithstanding, the rest of the country has different soils, and they all have different names to characterize them, because they all have different percentages of components, different structures, different colors. Soils come in gosh, all different kinds of colors. And I didn't realize that until someone gave me, and I think it was Dr. Evans gave me, it's almost like paint swatches, but it's all the colors of soils that have been discovered so far. It was just fascinating. There were hundreds, hundreds of colors.
And we think of it as one color.
Oh, yeah. Right, if you go into the south, the soils there are very red in color. That's mainly due to the iron that's present in the soils. If you go to an area where they're saturated conditions, so it's the soil is waterlogged, sometimes you'll see more of a blue color in the soil. There's a really good example of this if you actually go out to the Southport Beach House in Kenosha. When you're walking south from the Southport Beach House, there's that trail that has been eroded. Like, you'll get to the end of the trail and just kind of stops because there's been all this erosion, and there's a section where the trail's been eroded away and you can see down into the soil. And if you look down by the lake, there's a layer of clay right next to the lake that has that beautiful blue color that I like showing people, because you usually don't get to see that in soils in your backyard.
Wow. So you were talking about, well, first of all, there's all these different kinds of soils, and you were talking about the really important components, nitrogen and phosphorus, and what was the other?
Potassium is the other one. Those are important for farmers.
Right.
Yeah.
So do those matter to differing extents depending on what we're trying to grow there?
Absolutely.
So
yeah.
So give us some examples.
The example would be the potato, which is a very delicious crop, but I like to say it's kind of an environmental disaster. Potatoes are very greedy in nature. They don't need a lot of nitrogen, but they like having a lot of nitrogen around them. So potatoes would like to grow in very sandy soils. So we grow a lot of our potatoes in the Central Sands region of Wisconsin, which is primarily Adams County and surrounding counties. And sandy soil doesn't have high organic matter, and it doesn't have a high percentage of clay. So when rain, you guys have all been to the beach at some point, right? Like, sand doesn't really hold water very well, right? So in our sandy soils, we see a lot of this process that we call leaching. And that's the movement of water through the soil profile that's picking up different potentially nutrients and particles and carrying it with it to lower horizons. And in the Central Sands region, they grow a lot of potatoes, which is delicious, and I love potatoes, but potatoes are greedy and they want nitrogen around them in order to, they like having this like blanket of nitrogen around them so they feel secure, then they have higher yields and they're very happy, but they only use about 30% of the nitrogen that's applied to them, and because
so they don't absorb it, they don't take much of it in.
Yes, they just for some, and I'm not a plant specialist, so maybe the next person you have on can address the physiology of why potatoes are like
the
this.
The greediness of potatoes,
but they only use about 30% of the nitrogen that's applied, and the rest of it is in the soil profile. And because sandy soils aren't very good at hanging on to water and nutrients, a lot of that nitrogen can leach through the soil profile and end up in their groundwater. And we've seen this. Madison has a research station in Hancock, which is just outside of Adams County, but still with the sandy soils. And their groundwater there has high levels of nitrates. It also has high levels of pesticides. Conventional potatoes are sprayed with pesticides every other day. In a lot of cases, they're pretty susceptible to, because potatoes are, how you grow potatoes that you take a tuber from the year before and then you cut it up and then you take those little pieces and you plant it. So they're all genetically similar, right? Because they're basically the same plant that's been cut up. So if there's an insect or a bug that moves into the area, all your plants are the same, right? Like, we've seen this in basic biology, that you want a good diversity of genetics, because if something moves in that could potentially harm one set of organisms with similar genetics, maybe they'd be impacted, but all these other animals or plants wouldn't be. But when you have all the potatoes that are basically the same potato, if you have a bug that comes in that really likes that potato, your whole crop can be threatened from that.
And then you have potato famines and that kind of
Yeah. So potatoes use, and then depending on just looking at different crops, corn uses some nitrogen. Alfalfa is a plant that we call, it's called a legume. And those legumes are plants that are able to, we call it a symbiotic relationship. It's a relationship between two organisms that live very close together, and they both benefit from some type of partnership they have. And so legumes and the alfalfa, for instance, they make these little, they call them nodules on their roots, which are just basically like if you pull up an alfalfa plant, you'll see these little white balls on their roots. And that's a little home that they've made for that nitrogen-fixing bacteria that I talked about earlier. So they send out this little signal into the soil that's like, ooh, I have a home for you. Come live with me. And then the nitrogen-fixing bacteria come over and they move into these little nodules. And then they provide the plant with nitrogen. And the plant in return provides them with water and other nutrients and shelter. And so these plants historically haven't needed as much nitrogen to grow as other crops because they're able to fix some of their own. This is why you'll see like farmers do crop rotation and they usually rotate in. Like a soybean is also a legume. Soybeans and alfalfa during different years to capture more nitrogen in their soil. With some of the new strands of alfalfa that we're growing, because it grows so quickly and has such a high yield, farmers have actually been applying nitrogen fertilizer because the plant doesn't have time to fix all that nitrogen before they could maximize that yield with adding nitrogen fertilizer as well. So that's kind of a little sad that you have to apply your own. But legumes are really great. Yeah, they're really good. Especially if you're going to have a farm field that you know is going to be fallow for a year, you're not going to grow anything on it. Growing some legumes on your farm field is a great way to just capture some extra nitrogen while you're waiting for things to grow the following
year. Keep it regenerated. Yeah. When we were talking about that exceptionally fertile soil just outside of Madison, you used the term loam.
Ooh.
Can you explain what that term exactly means? What
Sure.
does that refer to?
So that's referring to what we call the soil texture, which is the particle sizes within soil. So there's three main types. We call it sand, which everyone's familiar with, right? We've been to the beach. Clay, which is basically the particle size that you'd see if you've made ceramics at some point in your life, that's clay. And then we have a particle size that's in between sand and clay that we call silt, which feels like kind of like pancake batter. You've ever felt that. It's very smooth in nature, but it's bigger. It's not gritty like sand, but it's not sticky like clay either. It's more of a smooth color or feeling. So texture is the combination of the three of those. So we call a loam is more or less the equal combination of sand, silt, and clay within a soil. There's less clay than sand and silt because the properties of clay are more powerful than that of silt and sand because clays are able to obtain more water. They have charges. They can shrink and swell. So the percentage of clay is a little smaller, but loams are more or less equal compositions of the three.
Well, it sounds like what you're saying is it's a great combination.
I mean, loams are wonderful soils for agriculture.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so loam is good in this the context of what we're talking about.
Yes.
And we need more loam. So when you are studying something like soil, you and soil scientists, what are sort of the new horizons that are being explored in terms of wanting to understand soil better or on new levels?
The hot one right now has to do with climate change, and they call it carbon sequestration. And that's the idea of removing carbon dioxide from the atmosphere and having soils store it. So we're able to help lower that concentration of carbon dioxide. There's some work with using, they call them cover crops. Those are crops that you grow basically during the off season of farming. So you'd plant your cover crop at the end of your growing season, and then you let it grow until the beginning of your season the following year. In Wisconsin, we don't have a very good growing season for cover crops because it's cold. But we're still doing research with them with the idea that these plants could sequester carbon over the non-growing season, and then at the end of that winter period, those crops could be incorporated back into the soil or just left there, and we could grow our plants directly into them the following year. So that's a pretty big one. There's some, which I can't say I know anyone personally that's doing this, but hypothetically there are scientists out there that are looking at just like somehow physically removing carbon dioxide in the soil and like pump or from the air and like pumping it into a giant tank within the soil to hold it. So if you're the person that can come up with carbon sequestration, that's soil carbon is huge right now, primarily due to climate change. Cover crops are pretty big too. Research with cover crops, research with biofuels is a big one right now too. There's some, the biofuel center that I used to work for, they were looking at a whole bunch of different biofuel crops, some pretty untraditional ones as well, and looking at if they're able to sequester carbon as well, how good they would be in terms of producing a fuel, and looking at some of those alternatives that we need to start exploring.
Hmm. Wow. What about around the world? I mean, I mean, there's no such thing as American soil, I'm guessing, and so on. But are there any significant differences between, for instance, the typical soils one is going to find in the heart of Africa or in the rainforest or in the Siberia? I mean, I would be really curious to know just how wide a variance we're talking about when we really look at the whole globe.
Oh, yeah. The tropical rainforest has a very different sort type of soil than we have here. Their soils are very red in color, and although the tropical rainforest has the greatest biodiversity on Earth and has a lot of plants and animals, their soils are very nutrient poor. Oh. And that's because there's so much rain in the tropics that a lot of those organic matter and some of our nutrients are leached out of the soil because there's so much rain, and what remains behind are our minerals that are very resistant to weathering, which are usually iron and aluminum oxide, which aren't very nutritious for plants. So it's kind of an oxymoron, right? You have all these plants and all these animals, and they're doing great in the tropical rainforest, but your soils aren't very good for agriculture in the tropics because of that.
Interesting.
Which is neat. There's actually Dr. Bockheim out of Madison. I believe he retired a few years ago. He was developed a new, we call them soil orders, which are the types of soils, and he named the gelisol, which is the soil that occurs in Arctic regions, and you have to be a gelisol, you have to have permafrost in you, which is soil that's permanently frozen for at least 2 years. So those soils are very different from what we have here. Our soils usually don't freeze for 2 years at a time. They're usually bluer in color. We call it glaying when they have that blue-gray color, and they store a lot of organic matter within them, mainly because the organic matter, it's so cold that when organic matter is added to gelisols, they don't completely decompose. So they're great sources of storing. When we look at climate change and the Arctic regions are warming, some of that organic matter and that permafrost is beginning to melt and thaw, and that's causing the carbon within it to decompose and be released back into the atmosphere, which is what we don't want to have happen.
Yeah, plenty of carbon already.
Yes.
Interesting. What would be the best soil on Earth?
Oh, the best
soil. I mean, in terms of nutritious and fertile.
You want a loam that has a lot of organic matter in it, which would be the best. Yeah, it has good drainage. Really good structure, so that soil is held together very well, has a lot of organic matter to promote those bugs and keep the microbes happy, has a high concentration of nitrogen would be really good, and have that topsoil nice and thick. Like, you don't want just 2 inches of topsoil. You'd want a really nice, at least a foot of topsoil to keep those plants growing.
So for the typical listener hearing us today, What are the most important lessons that you want to leave with them in terms of how they treat the soil that is on their own property? What are the things that they should do, and what are the things that they should avoid doing for the sake of the health of the soil that they are responsible for?
One of the best things to not do is till. When you till the soil, you're breaking up the structure of that soil, which is a problem when you're looking at, like, people like to till because I think it makes the soil fluffy and makes the plant roots happy, which it does to an extent, but you're destroying that structure that has taken so long to form and is really important for water drainage and other things within the soil. So I'd say not to till.
At all?
If you do decide to till, you could do what the farmers do, which is what they call conservation tillage, which is where you go through your farm field with a tractor that, so they used to, used to be used more commonly, they called the moldboard plow, which is basically just like a slab of steel that go through the soil and cut the whole thing and flop it over on its side. So instead now they're using more of these like disc shapes on the back of their tractors that go through and just cut a little slit in the soil that they can put the seed in and then move on. So that's what you should do. Just, you know, make a little hole, put your seed, and then move on.
So maybe take like a hoe or something, but use it the long way rather than the wide way.
Or if you do really feel the urge to till, don't till deep. You know, don't till your whole topsoil. Just do enough that you can get your seeds in and then let them plant and move on from there. If you have a garden in your backyard, keeping during the winter months, putting some type of residue on top of it to protect it from the elements is really nice.
Residue like what?
Any plants that don't – if you have plants that die at the end of your season, instead of pulling them out, just let them stay. And they'll be at – you could chop them up if you wanted to and add it just like a nice litter layer to the top of your soil that's going to add carbon back to your soil, so your microbes will be super happy that they have a new food source, and it will also protect that soil throughout the summer. I think a big one, too, is people feel a lot of pressure to fertilize their lawns a lot. Particularly for lawns, we use phosphorus is the more common element that really makes your lawns pop green. And I see everyone fertilizing their lawns in November or October in the fall time. And no, don't do that. You don't need to. Your grass is dying. You shouldn't fertilize it. Winter is coming. It's okay. And then all that fertilizer that you're adding, I mean, sure, some of it's going to be taken up by the plants, but a lot of it's going to just be excess. And phosphorus in particular, phosphorus isn't quite like nitrogen, where nitrogen leaches through the soil profile and ends up in your groundwater if there's excess amounts. Phosphorus is very sticky, and so it sticks to soil particles. And if you have soil erosion, that the phosphorus will go with those soil particles. It can end up in surface water bodies. This is why we have primarily, like if you look at the example of Madison, their lakes, they have blue-green algae every year. It causes eutrophication to occur if you have excess nitrogen and phosphorus within your surface waters, where you get those dead zones that occur, and there's low oxygen conditions, and we want to avoid that. So I would say be careful about how much fertilizer you're applying to your lawn. The fertilizer industry won't like me for this, but there's a lot of pressure from lawn companies to apply fertilizers to your lawn every year, multiple times a year, and that's really not necessary. Mm-hmm. You don't need to do. I would say if you're the type of person that really wants to fertilize your lawn, do it every couple of years. I mean, be smart about the time of year when you decide to do this. Don't fertilize in early spring when we get a lot of rains. That's just going to wash it away. And I wouldn't wait till the end of the season either. Try to get it maybe more of that early summertime when your grass really is. The idea is you want to apply fertilizer when the plant needs it most. So everyone is familiar with their lawns and knows when their grass really starts to take off and start growing. And that's about the time when you should apply the fertilizer.
And if in doubt, just get your soil tested.
Yes.
Don't fertilize unless you have your soil tested, because you may be wasting a lot of money on something that you don't need and something that the soil doesn't need.
Good point.
Yeah, then it's just going to end up in the environment and contaminate, and that's no one wants that.
So get to know your soil and appreciate it and treat it with loving care.
Yeah, and there's little kits you can buy at, like Stein's sells them. They're just little homemade kits you can run in your backyard to do a test yourself. If you really want to send it off to a lab, there are labs throughout the state that you'll go in your backyard and fill up a little, like a little sandwich baggie they send you in the mail of soil, then you ship it off and then they analyze it for you.
Wow.
And then it comes back.
That's something that probably a lot of people should do, just to know their soil and all that's in it.
Yeah, I would say if you want to do that, if you're not using the home kit, which runs it pretty quickly, if you want to actually send it off to a legitimate lab, you'd probably want to do that in the fall, at the end of the fall season, with the assumption that some of the nutrients in your soil will be lost over the winter because of leaching, but not a lot. But then you'll have those results in time for springtime to know how much to apply. Sometimes what happens if you wait until spring to sample, you won't get the results until like August. And then if you should have applied, you won't know till then.
Fascinating.
I'd also just quickly like to add that, just to echo what Laura was saying in the beginning, a teaspoon of soil contains billions of living things. And I think you said half of which we don't even know.
Oh, probably
what they are.
More. Yeah.
So when you become convinced that you have to go get pesticides to put on your lawn to kill grubs or to kill this and to kill that, just keep in mind that's probably not the only thing that you're killing. And some of the things that will be done in, we don't know what they are and what role they play, and they all do play a role. So, you know, there are other ways to address turf lawns that don't necessarily involve what we call biocides, which are herbicides and pesticides, that involve a much more sustainable and environmentally beneficial practice. So we would be happy to get you information on that if you'd like that. And, wonderful. You know, you can Google it.
Yep, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Well, it's. I think we've made a great strides towards helping everybody listening today to understand and appreciate the miracle that is in the soil beneath us. And I really appreciate this opportunity to learn so much about something so important. Laura Schultz is with the Environmental Studies faculty at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside. Laura, it was great to have you here. Thank you so much for all the expertise that you shared.
Oh, thanks for having me. This was really fun.
Nan Calvert, great to have you as well. We'll share your calendar of environmental events on tomorrow's morning show.
Okay.
So we'll have people make a point of listening for that. And thank you for making today possible. This was a great interview.
It was my pleasure. Thank you. Thanks, Laura.
Thank you.
Tomorrow we'll